And now, as Election Day draws near, let's take a wistful look back at the way pop culture has been intertwined into this presidential campaign.
Come gather round, Dick Condit, Scooter, and Rove. It's time to get packing. We must hit the road.
Are you running, or are you going to announce that you're running?
The last time we were on this program, you asked me if I would come back, right, if I was going to announce.
Yes.
I am announcing that I will be a candidate for President of the United States.
Oh, wow.
Oh, it's time for some campaigning.
For too long in this country, the press has been hearing the same old refrain. They're tired of being told you journalists have to stay neutral. You can't openly take sides in a political campaign. And they're saying, yes, we can.
Cause I gotta cry.
He's the biggest celebrity in the world, but is he ready to lead?
Hey, America, I'm Paris Hilton, and I'm a celebrity too. Only I'm not from the olden days, and I'm not promising change like that other guy. I'm just hot.
He's hot. Sexy. A hero patriot.
Senator John McCain was supposed to be on the program tonight. Were you aware of that?
Yeah.
We're told now that the senator has concluded his interview with Katie Couric, and he's now on Rachel Ray's show making veal piccata.
I screwed up.
You know, we're going to take every aspect of the crisis and look at it, and then we're going to ask ourselves, what would a maverick do in this situation? And then, you know, we'll do that.
It was a creed written into the founding documents that declared the destiny of a nation. Yes, we can.
I'm making this video to urge you, all of you, to schlep over to Florida and convince your grandparents to vote Obama. It can make the difference.
In Senator Obama's quest to become the president of television, Obama bought a half-hour infomercial. His whole campaign is like the craziest movie premise ever. Barack Obama has 5 days to spend $150 million. If he makes it, he wins the presidency.
We, however, can only afford QVC.
You can get on the train or get out.
Just a few of the ways, the many ways, the campaign invaded pop culture. If you want to see where we found all those clips, go to our website, npr.org, and let us know what we missed.
Anywhere across the USA, or you can get on the train or get out of the way. We're all just raising the cane. I said we're all just raising the cane.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel, and we're going to remember Studs Terkel now, the oral historian, author, and radio personality. Studs passed away today at the age of 96. He traveled across the country interviewing people from all walks of life about war, about their jobs, and about their dreams. His conversations with the prominent and the uncelebrated have become a map of 20th century America. NPR's Cheryl Corley has this story about the life and work of Studs Terkel.
His trademarks were the red gingham shirts he often wore, red socks, and his nickname, borrowed from a 1930s trilogy he loved, James Farrell's Studs Lonergan books.
But one time it did get me in trouble because of that nickname. Working came out, and I got a letter from a librarian somewhere in Georgia. I remember her name, Sylvia Cooper. She says, you know, I have volunteers working for me, but one of them is a spy for the Reverend Jerry Falwell, and they're spying on me. They're taking what they call dirty books or dirty ideas and words. And so one day he comes up to me and says, Miss Cooper, a request came for a book. And I said, we do not carry pornographic literature. And she said, what's the name of the book? He said, I believe it's called Working Studs by Terkel.
Terkel regaled a Chicago audience in 2000 with stories about his life. He was born Louis Terkel, May 16, 1912, in New York City. But like Al Capone, he moved to Chicago, and his tough guy nickname and raspy voice fit right in, says radio personality and author Garrison Keillor.
He sounded like a gangster on the radio. He really sounded like a tough guy, sounded like he was packing heat. But he was a lefty, and that was an unusual combination. So that's what fascinated me about him, first of all. He was such a great actor on the radio. Then, of course, I met him, and he turned out to be a little guy with that small-time gangster voice.
Turkle played gangsters during the early days of radio.
I was born a gangster. I was raised in a certain community, Wells and Grand Avenue, and it was sort of mob-oriented, but there were good people in between there. And so back in those days, there were three gangsters in all the radio soap operas, and I was always the dumb one. And that provided bread and butter for a while, till I became a disc jockey.
Turkle moved from radio to television, but he was blacklisted during the McCarthy era because his beliefs in workers' rights, rent control, and Social Security were labeled socialist, and his TV show Studs Place was canceled. Studs would say, long live the blacklist, because he may never have landed the job that launched him on the path he followed for most of the rest of his life. After hearing Woody Guthrie on Chicago's fine arts radio station, WFMT, he called the station and asked for a job. He was hired. He held court in the studio and took the show on the road. In 1960, he broadcast from Chicago's Roosevelt University.
We're seated next to Langston Hughes, who you might call as a quadruple threat man, poet, composer, playwright, novelist, shorts. Langston and brother John Sellers is here, too, whom we'll hear in a moment. Langston, what is the blues? How would you describe it?
Well, the blues are certainly the roots of jazz.
Turkle broadcast on WFMT for 45 years, interviewing playwrights, authors, architects, singers, and more. His title was not host, but free spirit, as he wove interviews, music, and poetry together. But just as with his books, he offered history from the bottom up, interviewing everyday people. Studs Turkle carried his tape recorder on a train and talked to riders as they traveled from Chicago to Washington, D.C. for one of the country's most historic civil rights marches.
How do you feel now on this train in 1963 about being Negro?
I feel wonderful. I don't believe in the Bible a lot, but I believe one thing, that everything that's going on is a part of the creation.
Turkle loved to talk. He had a legendary memory. One of his greatest talents was his ability to listen. Like a musician, his interviews were jazz-like, often no written questions. He'd pick up on a riff and improvise. Turkle's longtime friend, Pete Seeger, says music was often at the heart of Turkle's understanding of people.
In the early days, he was mainly a jazz fan, and then blues, and then world music of one sort or another. He simply knew people and was fascinated in their music and how their music expressed their history and their hopes.
Studs Terkel's first book was not published until he was 45 years old. The Giants of Jazz celebrated the music of Duke Ellington, Big Spiderbeck, and others. The oral histories would come a decade later, and Turkle wrote almost a dozen of them, exploring people's lives nearly to the end of his own.
All the books deal with the lives of ordinary people, not celebrities, quote unquote. What is it like to be a certain kind of person in a certain circumstance at a certain time?
Studs just loved people deeply, profoundly, and with endless enthusiasm.
Author Sidney Lewis worked with Turkle at WFMT and transcribed many of his interviews.
You know, I would listen and I would be observing as I was typing, and suddenly someone would just open this floodgate inside themselves, and I'd think, what is it that he did? What did he say? What did he ask that made this happen? It was not any one thing ever. It was just something about his presence and the attention and interest and genuine, really deep curiosity that he brought.
Studs Terkel often said America suffered from what he called a national Alzheimer's disease. So he wrote books like his Pulitzer Prize winner, The Good War, and Hard Times, an oral history of the Great Depression, to jar people's memories.
People forget what it was like. What was it like to be the little boy who saw his father come home one day with a tool chest on his shoulder, 11 o'clock that morning, and not work for 5 years? Many young kids were furious and angry at their parents for not telling them what it was like.
Turkle said it was his job to reveal that everyday history. As he neared 90, he tackled the subject of death. Turkle interviewed doctors, mothers, and others about an experience he said should be talked about as a matter of course. Shortly after he began working on the book, his wife of 60 years, Ida, died. Turkle would go on to write even more before he died. In a 1999 NPR interview, he talked about his own demise.
I'm curious, you know, my epitaph, I hope, will be, "Curiosity did not kill this cat."
When Turkle received the National Humanities Award in 1997, President Clinton said no one had done more to expand the American Library of Voices than Studs Terkel. That library is now open for all to hear at the Chicago History Museum. Cheryl Corley, NPR News, Chicago.
And once again, Studs Terkel died today at his home in Chicago. He was 96 years old. Finally this hour, time for a dispatch on the mixed-up lives of vampires. They're best known for sucking their victims' blood, but somehow vampires manage to be eerily attractive, at least in pop culture. Two series are dominating bestseller lists, the Twilight books and the Southern Vampire books, which are the basis of HBO's latest hit, True Blood. Both have vampire heroes who practice remarkable restraint, as NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome.
You don't see much blood, or fangs for that matter, in the 1931 film Dracula, but when Bela Lugosi leans over his victims, he is one creepy guy. And when this vampire wants a pretty woman, he takes her with no remorse. Vampires, or something like them, have been part of culture since ancient times, says my colleague Eric Newsom, who has written about the creatures in his book, The Dead Travel Fast. And while vampires cannot see their own reflection in the mirror, Newsom says they are a perfect reflection of the culture which creates them.
You look at vampires from any given era and you see what they thought was frightening. You see what they thought was sexy and what they thought was forbidden.
The latest craze, Newsom says, is the romantic, even chivalrous vampire. Take True Blood, for example. The HBO series is set in a time when vampires prowl openly through small-town America and even campaign for their civil rights. Suki Stackhouse, a young, pretty waitress, falls for a vampire named Bill. And like any young woman, her interest only intensifies when others object to her new crush.
He's not like that?
Okay, you spoke to him for like a minute. You don't know how many people he's sucked the blood out of over the last however many centuries he's been alive.
But he's so not scary.
Sweet Jesus in heaven, Suki, he is a vampire.
True Blood is based on the Southern Vampires book series written by Charlaine Harris. She inhabits her fictional world with both good and bad vampires. But in Bill, she creates a genteel vampire who protects Suki from the worst of his kind, even as he tries to rein in his own baser instincts. And of course, says Harris, his restraint makes him all the more alluring.
Yes, definitely. Gosh. I could rip you limb from limb, but because I think you're so great, I'm going to be very, very careful. That's got to be kind of intoxicating.
But the gentleman vampire who has stolen the heart of teenage girls everywhere is Edward, the hero of Stephenie Meyer's Twilight series, soon to be released as a movie. Edward's fans live vicariously through his romance with high school sweetheart Bella.
You know what you are? Your skin is pale white and ice cold. Don't go out into the sunlight.
Say it out loud. Say it.
Vampire.
Are you afraid?
No.
Edward and his clan refuse to feed off humans, and it is that choice, says Meyer, that makes him so popular.
These are vampires who should be these creatures who exist to hunt humans. I mean, they're evil, and they choose something different. They find another way, and I think that kids respond to the idea that it doesn't matter where I am in life, I always have a choice.
Vampires aren't supposed to be restrained. They're all our hungers. That's why they're vampires.
Nina Auerbach, author of Our Vampires Ourselves, believes every age gets the vampire it wants. In the 1960s and 70s, she says, vampires took young women away from their narrow lives and transformed them. It's understandable, she says, that with the advent of AIDS, uninhibited bloodsucking may have lost some of its appeal. Still, she finds this latest crop of vampires kind of boring.
And these are very abstinent vampires. The implication being, if he truly loves you, he will not do it to you. And I'm old, and I thought if he truly loves you, you would have a wonderful time together.
Whether they terrify, entrance, or court their victims, vampires are always on the prowl, waiting for that moment when the moon comes out and the cultural spotlight shines on them again. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
Wow, my head is spinning a little bit. Okay, we've talked about everything on the show today, politics, race, the economy, baseball, sort of. It's all pretty heavy stuff. Let's have some dessert now. Fashion. Here's independent producer Shereen Meraji.
This one goes out to all the NPR ladies. Okay, tussle your hair, and if you're not driving, take off those hideous Dansko clogs you love wearing and kick up your feet. Now let's listen to a Hollywood legend to get us in the fashion mood.
And here's a song I think you want to hear. Falling in love again.
Marlene Dietrich was in love with shoes. When she died, there were 440 pair in her closet. She thought shoes were more important than dresses, adding elegance to any outfit.
Stiletto pumps in the club. Yeah.
But would Marlene wear Christian Louis Vuitton's 8-inch stiletto pumps to a cabaret club? According to Los Angeles Times fashion critic Booth Moore, the higher the better.
It's a competition. It's like it used to be, you know, how hard could you work or how hard could you work out? Now it's like how high a heel could you work, you know?
This fall at fashion weeks all over the globe, models stomped along the catwalk in higher heels than ever before.
I was at the Prada show in Milan and the shoes were unbelievably painful looking. They were strappy, very, very high. So they were slipping and sliding and falling down on the runway. And everyone after that show was just complaining about how excruciating it was to watch these women walking in these shoes.
Elegant indeed. For those of you crazy enough to try high-stepping in pin-thin heels, you may want to take a class first.
From the top, you have It's Britney, Bitch, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Catherine Corelli is a professional dancer and instructor at Crunch Gym in Hollywood.
Down.
She teaches a class where students learn how to strut in stilettos.
I think that it gives you a platform and opportunity to work on posture, kind of building up the feet, building up those ankles and calves, and that ultimately will help your back, it will help your posture. Shoes are fabulous, but not a lot of people know how to walk in them.
To the left, 4 walks forward. Pull around. Hip, 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 hip.
Corelli and a handful of students in super high heels popped their hips and straddled chairs to Britney Spears' Give Me More.
7, 8.
And at the end of class, the lone male student, L.A. stylist Peter Tucci, told me why shoe designers keep taking their heels to new heights.
It's much easier to rip off the runways, and it's much harder to make a shoe look really expensive and more durable. So that's the one thing, like, I guess maybe the rich or someone who can save their money can buy and have it as a luxury item.
Basically, you can remake a Marc by Marc Jacobs dress, but don't try and fake an 8-inch stiletto without breaking ankles all over the world. I miss my clogs already. For NPR News, I'm Shereen Meraji.
This is Why We Don't Walk in L.A. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Madeline Brand.
And I'm Alex Chadwick.